Hello and welcome to The Goldsmith Odyssey, the podcast where we examine that fortunate canon of films graced by the touch of legendary composer Jerry Goldsmith. I'm Jens.
I'm Yavar.
I'm Clark.
On this show, we'll be going through the maestro's filmography in as chronological an order as availability allows. We'll put each film into context, we'll discuss the plot in a way that hopefully preserves the viewing experience, and we'll review it honestly. Then, in the back half of the show, we'll get into the music, how Jerry approaches each movie, his artistic intent, and how he impacts our appreciation of said film.
So I guess we should talk about why we've decided on this particular theme for this podcast, why Jerry Goldsmith in particular. And I think this would be an ideal moment for all of us to kind of share what Jerry Goldsmith means to us and why we've kind of gravitated to him as a subject.
I was first introduced to the music of Jerry Goldsmith when I was probably 6 or 7 years old, watching Star Trek The Next Generation with my grandfather. Of course, he wasn't directly involved with that series, but his music was used and kind of entered my psyche and led to me becoming a film music fan later in life as a teenager. And then I went and discovered more of his works, and eventually he became my favorite film composer.
I was first introduced to the music of Jerry Goldsmith when I was a kid through the movie Rudy, which I really didn't think was much of a movie even at the time, but the score made a big impression on me, and it was one of the two first soundtracks that I bought. And the deeper I dug into Mr. Goldsmith's music over the years, the more fascinated I grew by his compositional style and by his remarkable ability to do just about anything he set his mind to. One of those rare composers who is good at genuinely everything, and over time has become probably my all-time favorite film composer.
Yeah, it was also my teenage years. I mean, the reason I love him is just something about the way he writes, right? The way he constructs a cue, the way that he resolves his melodies, he times his rhythms, you know, something about it, it just gives me chills. His action music is what grabbed me the most early on, in particular the unusual time signatures and the juxtaposition, the call and response between his motifs that would tend to form the building blocks of those cues. It's just so satisfying to me.
I completely agree. For me, what's unique about Jerry Goldsmith compared with many film composers is that the more I listen to him, the more I get out of it. Whereas sometimes with certain other composers, you can get burnt out on a piece. I actually kind of tend to fall deeper in love with a Jerry Goldsmith piece the more I hear it.
I agree with that too, especially when you're listening to the full score and you're realizing all of the little connections that he's put in place that you might have missed the first time around, and how many brilliant little things he does that you don't necessarily pick up on your very first listen. But almost all of them get richer with repeat listens.
He's so precise with his sound mixes. Mm-hmm. You know, every element is so carefully placed on the soundstage in a way that makes it possible to just pick out each individual little element.
It's not just the sound mix. It's also his actual writing and orchestration. He has this kind of clarity where you hear all the different layers in detail. He doesn't tend to kind of blend sounds together. Every clear line musically stands out.
There's something that I'm sure both of you have heard a lot of times, which is that Jerry Goldsmith is sort of infamous for being a composer who writes great music for terrible movies. And we're going to kind of investigate that idea, I suppose, over the course of this podcast, and then see how accurate that is on a case-by-case basis.
There are a couple of things that make his filmography really ideal to cover for a podcast like this. These movies truly span the gamut in terms of everything, not just quality, right? You know, you've got some of the greatest films of all time here.
Sure.
But you've also got just some of the most bafflingly weird and misguided stuff that I've ever seen, as well as genuinely obscure works that deserve cult status in a way that they just don't have at the moment.
It's interesting. I think Jerry Goldsmith is a composer who never really got typecast. Like, certainly he, you know, a science fiction assignment might get him another science fiction assignment. But look at Georges Delerue. He it feels like 95% of the time he was scoring romances and such because he wrote such gorgeous music. But when he sometimes got a project like Something Wicked This Way Comes, you could see that he had a little bit more range than he maybe usually got to display. But Jerry Goldsmith always, in every decade of his career, got to display his full range. He didn't, you know, do a string of comedies and then a string of westerns and then a string of like Elmer Bernstein, you know, famously complained about. He mixed it up all the way over the course of his career.
But yeah, just that filmography, it's almost like a miniature showcase of what Jerry Goldsmith can do, because, you know, those films are such different films and the scores are such different scores. And, you know, whatever you want to say about the filmography of Jerry Goldsmith and the qualities of the films themselves, one of the great benefits of him working on such a diverse array of films is we got such a diverse array of music. And there's so many different kinds of Jerry Goldsmith scores, which is part of what makes revisiting different pieces of his career so fun.
One of the things I admire most about him is that, unlike, say, Elmer Bernstein, all of his Western scores sound different and distinct from each other. The whole style and approach is extremely varied. And even within the same franchise, like The Omen, he wrote three very different scores.
He has a core underlying style that's recognizable from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are recurring ideas that can be found in the late 50s up to the 2000s. That are very like, oh, here's that soul, you know, the lone noble trumpet theme, you know, that you hear in so many Jerry Goldsmith scores.
And the low-end piano and all of those.
You've got identifiers, but then he was obsessed with innovating in and with doing something new and unique for each movie, that his style just becomes obfuscated to the point where, to a general movie-going audience, he's not recognizable from score to score. So whenever sites like Classic FM do their greatest film composer of all time online polls, Jerry rarely cracks the top five in those, and I'm certain that a big factor for that is that folks literally can't recognize his work in the way that they instantly recognize, say, a John Williams or an Ennio Morricone.
Or Bernard Herrmann, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm in love with his music so much, I can instantly recognize his style always, no matter the genre, but he does have this reputation of being a chameleon, so I think I may be too close to it to really assess
for us,
that. Yes.
For us, it's a different thing.
Right, we're obsessives, and hopefully over the course of this series, we'll turn one or two other people into obsessives as well. Join us.
We'll point out as we go kind of the genesis of certain stylistic traits that he developed early on that would then carry through all of the decades of his work. Some people think that Jerry Goldsmith came onto the film scoring scene kind of fully formed with his style, much as people say about Korngold, but he actually was honing his craft early on in radio and live television. We thought we would start with an introductory episode covering some of his live television and radio work before getting into feature films, to sort of give a context for how he ended up as the film composer Jerry Goldsmith.
So Jerry first got into radio because an acquaintance of his was working at CBS, who knew of his talents, and this acquaintance figured that he would be perfect to contribute music to the CBS radio workshop, which allowed, at the time, CBS employees, even ones that weren't in creative positions, to help produce a radio show once per week. So they hired him under the pretense of being a typist, faked the typing test for him, and let him compose music. About a half a year later, he was able to present his compositions to the head of music there, and got promoted to the radio music department working on Hallmark Playhouse. He worked on selecting and editing the archival music for that show, then timing it to the live broadcast. He was controlling it in the way that a DJ would, and over time he came to add up to 8 turntables.
DJ JG.
So he would do little transitional compositions to blend his library music together. He was able to, you know, eventually convince his higher ups that an orchestra would be cheaper and more efficient than doing these elaborate needle drops. An orchestra in this case basically being just a dude on a flute and Jerry playing the piano. But that's how he got to you know, really regularly start writing music for these shows.
Such as?
Romance, Suspense, Escape, Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, Hallmark Hall of Fame, Prime Classics, Frontier Gentleman. Now, Frontier Gentleman, he actually wrote proper music for. That was not a needle drop assignment. Similarly, with the first thing that we'll be talking about, which is the CBS Radio Workshop.
So let's talk about the CBS Radio Workshop a little bit. This was one of many different classic radio anthology series, and you already mentioned a couple of others like Suspense and Escape and some of these, but there were a ton of radio anthology series in the 1940s and 50s, but this one bears the distinction of being one of the most ambitious. It explored experimental ideas in the realm of both sound design and narrative, and the show offered a genuinely wide variety of unique programming.
I think CBS Radio Workshop was a particularly good, fertile ground for Jerry Goldsmith himself, because he was an experimenter, and sort of the experimental nature of that program, anything could come up on it, allowed him to really try different things and hone his craft, testing what worked dramatically, that was really beneficial for when he eventually became a film composer.
And one particularly distinctive episode, and one we're going to be talking about today, was 1,489 Words. It's a diverse collection of poetry readings. This was presented as a sort of a gentle challenge to the notion that a picture is worth 10,000 words. It offers up some words that attempt to prove that words are perhaps worth a little bit more than that. And this half-hour program offers four works performed by actor William Conrad: Alfred Noyes' iconic The Highwayman, Elizabeth Barrett Browning's romantic Sonnet 43, Thomas Wolfe's The Thunder of Imperial Names, which is actually an excerpt from Wolfe's short story The Names of the Nation, and finally the seven-word Japanese poem Silence. These are some interesting and eclectic choices, and they sort of begin with some real heavy hitters here. I think The Highwayman, even if you're not into poetry...
Considered one of the great narrative poems.
Right. Right, and just sort of a terrific and instantly memorable sort of romantic melodrama of sorts, and given just a wonderful treatment here by Mr. Conrad, I think.
Mr. Goldsmith, if you please, overture for The Highwayman. Was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor. And the highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. He had a French cock hat on his forehead, a bunch of lace at his chin, a coat of the claret velvet, and his breeches of brown doeskin. They fitted with never a wrinkle. His boots were up to the thigh, and he rode with a jeweled twinkle. His pistol butts a twinkle, his rapier hilt a twinkle under the jeweled sky. Over the cobbles he clattered and clashed in the dark inn yard, and he tapped with his whip on the shutters, but all was locked and barred. He whistled a tune to the window, and who should be waiting there but the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess. The landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair. And dark in the dark old inn yard, a staple wicket creaked, where Tim the ostler listened. His face was white and peaked, his eyes were hollows of madness, his hair like moldy hay. But he loved the landlord's daughter, the landlord's red-lipped daughter. Dumb as a dog, he listened, and he heard the robber say, One kiss, my Bonnie sweetheart. I'm after a prize tonight, but I shall be back with the yellow gold before the morning lights. Yet if they press me sharply and harry me through the day, then look for me by moonlight. Watch for me by moonlight. I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way. He rose upright in his stirrups. He scarce could reach her hand, but she loosened her hair in the casement. His face burned like a brand as the black cascade of perfume came tumbling o'er his breast. And he kissed its waves in the moonlight. Oh, sweet black waves in the moonlight. Then he tugged at his rein in the moonlight and galloped away to the west.
So there we've just heard an early Jerry Goldsmith love theme and a very, very gorgeous one at that.
Yeah, it's just sublime.
And this piece overall really kind of covers a lot of emotional territory, but a very sort of turbulent piece of music that really kind of captures the sort of melodramatic feeling of this poem, I think.
The swirling action at the beginning of the overture really gives us a clue into how good Jerry Goldsmith would be at that genre, too, I believe.
Right. It's very striking to me, listening to this in particular, not so much some of the other things that we're going to be talking about on the program today, but with this 1,489 words episode, and this piece in particular, this really feels like the work of a fully formed, sort of mature composer who really knows what he's doing and has a great command of his craft. It's really a standout work.
You know, this score is very in the moment. He scores each stanza like it is a scene in a film. The way that you'd be picturing it in your head. The music is carefully timed to sync up to the reading very precisely. It's clearly structured in such a way to give the music space and to let the scenes play out in your mind's eye.
I would say it's almost better than the way his music is treated in a film score, because he's not really competing with, you know, a sound effects guy and the dialogue. It's kind of a cooperative piece. It's almost like he set a poem to music. So that you can imagine these pieces like being performed live at a concert with a reciter, something like Aaron Copland's Lincoln Portrait or something like that.
I think this is also a great piece to open with, because it is the poem of all of these that feels the most like a radio drama. You know, it has despite the very poetic style and the repeated phrases and all of that, it's a very compelling story. And has a very kind of straightforward narrative. And it works really well as kind of an attention-getting thing before they move in a more kind of blatantly poetic direction later.
Really, he has perfected the art of writing music that goes under narration already at this point in his career. I mean, he knows exactly how to accentuate the poetry, how to convey the mood of the scene without being intrusive.
And it's not an easy thing to do, and there's a reason that so many old radio shows really don't have a lot of music when people are speaking. It's because it is difficult to write music that's effective with words and doesn't feel like it's competing with them. There's a real art to it, and he does that exceptionally well here.
In fact, at the end of this program, we'll have the ability to contrast a lot with that Frontier Gentleman show, because that is an example where, for the most part, you'll have a dialogue scene, and then it'll be a music cue, you know, for some sort of transition or some action or something like that. In this piece, it's so different because the music and the sound effects and the poetry are all in an intricately planned dance together, and they kind of flow in a really unique way. This radio show, 1,489 words, no piece in it feels like Jerry Goldsmith is writing cues. It feels like he's kind of through composing each one. There's no stopping and starting of the music that really stands out.
And that's something that sort of adds to the kind of poetic feel of the music, the way that everything flows into everything else.
I think another thing that sets The Highwayman apart is that this little, like, what is it, 7 minutes, 8 minute piece? It has more themes and unique moments than some film scores. You've got the overture, you've got the love theme, you've got a horn fanfare for when the highwayman rides off on his looting adventures. You've got several unique drama and suspense pieces that underscore the capture of His Girlfriend and Imprisonment by King George's Men.
You've got the martial music for the Redcoat.
Yeah,
there's some more Mysterioso stuff as well.
The love theme that we just played, actually beyond that point, it goes into this little mysterious and menacing motif for the jealous man who gives them up to the authorities, which I really like.
Goldsmith needs less than 5 seconds to establish a theme, a strong one.
But yeah, and of course the final confrontation and the eerily beautiful final statement of the love theme.
The ghostly return, yes. It feels perfect. It feels like a perfect piece.
So the next poem is another very well-known thing, Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Sonnet 43, which is, it's a very brief poem, but probably has one of the most iconic opening lines of any romantic poem. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. And she begins counting from there. But it's a very, very charming little piece, and Mr. Goldsmith turns to a more romantic mood appropriately.
Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach, when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace.
It's not the kind of ravishing romantic theme that you get for the landlord's daughter, but it's kind of this more delicate harp-led. It put me in mind of his music for A Patch of Blue later on.
That was
on.
The exact same thing I thought of when I listened to it too, yeah.
It absolutely did sound like Goldsmith, like a mature Goldsmith to me. It didn't sound like he was, figuring out things. It sounded like him.
So Thomas Wolfe's The Thunder of Imperial Names is the third piece, and as we mentioned earlier, this is an excerpt from a short story he wrote, and as such, it's not really a traditional poem in the same way that the other pieces in this are. It's more of a dramatic reading, really. This is kind of the other big, diverse piece of this episode, a compelling slice of Americana that touches on names of great individuals and trains and rivers and a whole lot of other different things.
Battles,
yes.
I was just going to interject. What I wasn't sure about was whether the point of it was the sound of these names on their own merits, or whether it was appealing to Americans who actually, had a collective memory of these historical names. So I'd be really interested, particularly, Jens, in how it came off to somebody who didn't grow up in America initially. And, does it come off as, like, too patriotic or, sort of pompous or full of itself?
I'm a pretty patriotic guy.
Yeah.
So it's hard to go too patriotic for me. It is clear that we are meant to understand what these names mean and the historical significance of them. So when it refers to a famous battle, the assumption is that we know all about this battle, presumably, or at least enough that it would
mean
something.
Special resonance.
Right, but I don't think it's just like an all-American nostalgia piece. I think it's more complicated than that. That it's touching on a lot of things with complicated emotions behind them, and I think the music, at least to some degree, reflects that.
Then for the continental thunder of the states, the names of Montana, Texas, Arizona, Colorado, Michigan, Maryland, Virginia, and the two Dakotas, the names of Oregon, and Indiana, of Kansas and the rich Ohio, the powerful name of Pennsylvania, and the name of old Kentucky, the undulance of Alabama, the names of Florida and North Carolina.
I think that Jerry's approach is to represent the essence of these places and their majesty.
But Jerry's music doesn't come off as rah-rah patriotic. It's kind of it's dignified, and it sometimes it feels a little bit troubled or uneasy. It's not always like we're so great. It's not, in other words, it's not like his main theme to Air Force One or something like that.
No, it actually is more, I mean, though it is an introduction to what would become Goldsmith's staples over the years. You've got the somber French horns, the Marshall percussion, the booming trumpet. It's pretty close to the signature sound that he established for the many military films that he would come to score over the years. Hints of Twilight's Last Gleaming. To me,
but it always feels nuanced. It's not a two-dimensional piece of music, and I thought it's really interesting that all of these pieces in this radio program, it's the one to have a life beyond this radio show back in 1957, and it was actually recorded in the modern era, and you can buy it on CD if you want to. I think some military wind band or something performed it. That's unique out of all of his radio output. You know, he must have written hours and hours of radio programs, but this is the only piece, this small excerpt of the larger 1,489 words program.
I think if it wasn't for the music, this reading would come off as a little silly.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would come off like that old Monty Python sketch where Graham Chapman is reading off the woody words and the tinny words.
It feels very much like the music is actually the showcase, and it's like a musical piece with narrator.
Yeah, this piece definitely, unlike the others, I think this one wouldn't hold up as well on its own without this remarkable accompaniment. Last but not least, but well, at least in the sense that it's the shortest, we have the 7-word Japanese poem, Silence. This is a type of poem called a tanka. And, well, rather than discussing it, I suppose we can just go ahead and play it and let people hear it for themselves.
The butterfly sleeps on the temple bell.
So this is neat, but it's so short.
It's so brief, but he still makes a strong impression with his music with such a short amount of time. His music might go on longer than the actual poem does, but it bookends it.
Because I think it's an effective coda for this episode. Obviously, it's a much simpler, smaller thing, both musically and in terms of the amount of words being employed. But it makes an impression, and I like the fact that all of these works are very different things, and this one a very different type of poetry than any of the others featured on the program. And it's a nice little phrase, too. I like it. It sort of one of those phrases that lingers with you for a while.
It definitely has a sound that foreshadows future Asian-themed Jerry scores, of which he wrote quite a few.
Yeah, there's a large family of them, from the Sand Pebbles to the Challenge and so forth.
But I think, you know, it does the job it needs to do, but is overall the least sort of memorable for me of these pieces.
The best thing about the second and fourth pieces, though they are more slight, is that they do demonstrate his versatility. So interestingly, we're actually now going to move back in time to address a live television episode that Jerry Goldsmith scored.
So this is another CBS anthology series, but not a radio series, but as Yavar mentioned, a television series. It's called Climax, and this was a show that offered, again, a wide variety of stories, literary adaptations, dramatizations of real-life events, and original stories as well, a whole lot of different stuff. One of the best-known episodes of this series is Gore Vidal's adaptation of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, starring Michael Rennie in both of the lead roles. It's a mostly faithful adaptation of the Robert Louis Stevenson story that recreates the tale of Dr. Henry Jekyll, who's a good-hearted, ambitious man who creates a formula designed to help him learn more about the nature of the human soul. Jekyll then gets more than he bargained for, of course. The formula allows him to transform into the monstrous Mr. Hyde, who's a vile and violent figure who embraces all of the vices that Dr. Jekyll has avoided. So now we have two sides of a man's soul at war, but how much damage will be done before the war is over? In other words, it's Jekyll and Hyde.
Hearing the announcer credit Gore Vidal, I sat up and took notice. Vidal wrote Franklin J. Schaffner's The Best Man. I would consider myself a fan of Gore Vidal, so I had high expectations right away.
And where they met?
It's a pretty straightforward, simple adaptation of the book. We've got Jekyll obsessed with the dichotomy of good and evil and all that. He wants to split the soul in two, which, honestly, it seems like a really dumb thing to deliberately do to yourself. Mm-hmm. Regardless of scientific curiosity.
Well, you know, he doesn't really even have, like, much of a reason. He just wants to, like, dig out the human soul and poke around a little bit for science, but there's not like a driving motivation there. You know, he's not trying to uncover the cure for whatever. He just wants to play with it, and then, you know, someone else is like, well, maybe you shouldn't do that. And he's like, oh, it'll be fine. And, you know.
When he's challenged on it, I think he says something like, oh, I'm going to bring out the angel. And then immediately afterwards, they're like, what if you bring out the demon? And he's like, oh, it's worth it for science. He seems surprisingly unconcerned.
In most other versions of Jekyll and Hyde that I'm used to, which, by the way, one weird thing about this right away is that they pronounce his name Jekyll.
I noticed that.
which to me, it just sounds wrong after a lifetime of hearing it pronounced Jekyll in so many other versions.
It feels like this episode's version of It's Frankenstein.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
But... And this was after several famous adaptations had already been done. Like earlier that same decade, Spencer Tracy did a really good one. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly something that people would have been familiar with.
Yeah, there's a pretty scandalous pre-code version of Jekyll and Hyde from the, I forget if it's the late 20s or early 30s, out there as well.
You know, usually in the Jekyll and Hyde story, he doesn't really know what he's going to do to himself. He's not really foreseeing the consequences. Here, he really doesn't have an excuse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He gets very enthusiastic about it. Yeah, he very willingly indulges in being Mr. Hyde.
Never get any sense that there's like a real conflict. Like the inner Jekyll isn't in there sort of tugging on Mr. Hyde, say, no, don't do this. Hyde just sort of goes to town as soon as he's unleashed.
And he even says, well, I have complete control. I just really like letting the monster loose.
Right. As you say, this is a pretty straightforward adaptation. I think Michael Rennie, who's probably best known for The Day the Earth Stood Still, I think he's good as Jekyll. I think he's a little bit less effective as Hyde. And I think part of it is that Hyde, with some makeup work and everything, is basically made to look like Lou Ferrigno more than anything. And just kind of has his hair.
He gets a unibrow.
A unibrow. He gets his hair slicked back, get this kind of pompadour thing going. And it just doesn't have the sort of menacing, oh, this is a dangerous guy sort of effect that it's going for. But I understand this is, you know, a weekly TV series and they can only do so much. Another thing that's interesting is a lot of these episodes of Climax were filmed live and aired live. And I'm guessing this one was too, because there are a lot of little scenes where you sort of catch actors, you know, good actors like Sir Cedric Hardwick, who plays a supporting role, sort of missing a beat or something like that that you wouldn't expect them to do, and I think that's just a result of this being broadcast live, but that adds a little bit of charm to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Michael Rennie even makes a mistake and corrects himself.
Yes, I recall that.
You're right. There's a couple of flubbed line reads, and they give the game away. But it's kind of nifty how seamlessly it all comes off.
One thing I was wondering is how they... I mean, we were talking about how the makeup effects are relatively simple, but how did they pull that off for live television? And when they do that sort of dissolve thing, is the actor just hurriedly getting a little bit of makeup stuck on his face? Or I don't know how they achieved that and then were able to go back in time so quickly and film with the audience, whereas a film, you know, an actor would have hours to get put into makeup and do all of those scenes separately.
Yeah,
they do very simple video effects for the transformations, where it's just like, okay, here's like a ripple mm-hmm. kind of
and
thing.
And you slowly see his
reflection in a puddle with a crossfade.
It seems like those they might have filmed in advance or something. I don't know if that was possible, but...
It must have been. I mean, there was single-camera television at the time, wasn't there? It's just that the live shows were on a lower budget.
Right.
And we're just kind of putting on a show, unless I'm mistaken.
No, I think that's right. And I think there are some of those, as Yavar suggests, some of those effect shots were pre-recorded and sort of incorporated into the program while they did quick changes or whatever. It works for a live TV broadcast with the limitations it has. It works pretty well. I just wish the script by Mr. Vidal, who I agree is a very interesting and intelligent guy, were a little bit more adventurous with the story and tried to add its own something to it.
What do you think the strongest scene was out of the adaptation? For me, it was when later on Hyde comes to visit the friend, Dr. Lanyon. I think after he transforms back to Jekyll or Jekyll, that's some of the perhaps stronger writing, or maybe I just like Michael Rennie's performance in that when he's kind of pleading.
When he confronts him or lectures him on what he's been doing?
Yeah, I liked the actor who played Dr. Lanyon as well. I didn't recognize him. He's not a famous face like Cedric Hardwick, but I thought he did a really good job of playing off Michael Rennie's distress, holding him to task.
My favorite scenes are the scenes where the music really shines. So, like, the transformation scenes, or shortly after the transformation. Like, there's a exciting, stormy bit of action-y Goldsmith.
I like the scene, too, where Jekyll goes to visit the woman in the cabaret, sort of to apologize and make things right. This woman who's been terrorized by Hyde, had her lover killed by Hyde, and is just traumatized in every possible way. And Jekyll, you know, wants to kind of make things right. This is at the point where he decides to, you know, try and reform himself a little bit. And goes to visit her and talks about how he's going to help her out, and then things go south. I think that's a kind of enjoyably unsavory bit in this that stands out among some of the other scenes.
It was memorable. I'll definitely take away a memory of that.
On a musical level, I have to say this one, for me, didn't stand out as much as a lot of Goldsmith scores do, and that's understandable. This is just a, you know, an episode of the week sort of assignment. As Jens mentioned earlier, the cues that really stood out for me were the transformation scenes. Those have some really kind of striking and memorable writing. It's very sort of wild and turbulent and captures the mood of those pieces, those scenes, quite well. Thank you.
I do like what an anxious sounding score this is and how it reflects the mental state of the character. I think that aspect of it is very successful.
Right. He did his job for sure. But there's definitely little that that you're going to take with you afterward. And certainly intentionally, not a whole lot of very blatant melody present here.
It's probably worth commenting that it does look forward in some ways to his more famous music for Thriller or The Twilight Zone in terms of its more modernist approach. But for me, it's not quite as memorable as the best of those.
Mm. I mean, I think the woodwind writing is Herman-esque.
And it seems like rather than sustained themes, he kind of uses these repeated cells.
Yeah, in the same way that Bernard Herrmann would. Yeah.
A little bit. Maybe not exactly the same way, but yeah. in the spirit of the approach, a little similar. Sometimes he would incorporate the source music, because that does recur through the episode, because he visits that tavern multiple times as Mr. Hyde, and then finally as Dr. Jekyll, eventually transforming into Mr. Hyde. And there's this constant atmosphere of kind of lowbrow music, I guess, of cabaret singer in the background. And eventually that plays into Mr. Hyde's mental state kind of coming out of Dr. Jekyll when we see him troubled at the end, when he's speaking with the woman. And it clues us into the fact that he's about to transform before actually the full-on music cue enters. The way the organ comes in over the source music. So that struck me a little bit.
So finally, the last project we're going to talk about on this show is the radio drama Frontier Gentlemen. Now, we mentioned there were a lot of different anthology series in the 40s and 50s. There were also a ton of different Western series that appeared on radio during that era. But this one follows the adventures of J.B. Kendall, who's a British journalist for the Times of London who roams the American West in search of colorful stories to write for his newspaper. However, Kendall is no mere passive observer. He's good with a gun, and more often than not, he ends up right at the center of these stories that he's writing about. He's somebody who's well-spoken and polite, but if you back him into a corner, he becomes a dangerous adversary indeed. And in the pilot episode of this show, The Shelton Brothers, Kendall attempts to settle into a new town and quickly finds himself in conflict with a violent local gang.
I myself am very amused at how this proper British man shows all of the, you know, tough Americans how to be a real tough guy.
And does so while being just the most British, snottiest person imaginable. It's pretty fun in its way. But J.B. Kendall is, you know, the whole gimmick of the show is kind of a compelling one. You know, the American West is seen through the eyes of an outsider, but he really plays, the actor's John Daner, I should mention. He really...
From Texas.
Yes. He really plays up the Britishisms of his character.
I do think that he comes off really more smug and self-satisfied than British.
And it accentuates that he's always... Well, not always, but frequently contrasted with these sort of, you know, Western small-town yokels who are of the, you know, what are you talking about, Mr. Newspaper Man, sort of variety.
Yeah.
But
they're all caricatures of right. Dumb Americans.
Right.
So, like, right away, we've got the omniscient narrator introducing us to the town of South Sunday, mm-hmm. where the sheriff has banned all guns. The narration is unambiguous about this being a bad thing that will cost lives, you know, because the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is with a good J.B. Kendall.
And he certainly does. One of the most amusing things about this is that the show is pitched as sort of him chronicling interesting tales from the Old West, but it ends up becoming more, his columns are really more like his diary of misadventures he got involved in personally. He's always the guy at the center of everything.
He's never just along for the ride and
right.
he witnesses something. He's writing a column about himself,
and
the
he's
hero.
Punching people and shooting people and saving the damsels in distress and doing all of this. One thing that cracks me up, too, is the way that he always jumps into action with these oh-so-polite, in a kind of sarcastic, snotty sort of way, exclamations. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's the third episode where he commences a fistfight with something like, "Oh, no, that's not very nice." And, "Oh, no, this just won't do at all."
That's a pretty good J.B. Kendall.
Thank you. I am as British as he is.
Yes.
So he arrives in South Sunday. He meets the town sheriff, Frank Clanton, who explains how he's banned all guns. He meets a pretty girl named Lila, her goon boyfriend, Dick Farley, who thinks that Kendall is putting the moves on his girl, decides to take a swing at him. And this is when we first realize that Kendall is a secret badass. And we also realize that Dick is actually one of the Shelton brothers, a gang of criminals who are hiding out from Billy the Kid, and Kendall has made a dangerous enemy. They believe that Billy the Kid sent him, so now he must, of course, deal with that situation.
The secret badass is a common trope in Western films, you know, the iconic example being Destry, the character played by Jimmy Stewart in 1939 film.
Yeah, the badass that is underestimated by everyone.
Right.
In this case, because he's British.
But in this case, he's the most obnoxious, unknown badass imaginable, so he's less of a sympathetic character than that sort of character usually is.
We have yet to find the thing that he's not good at.
These characters are often, you know, these sort of quiet types that keep to themselves, and you know, they're very modest, and that's not really Kendall at all. He's chatty, and he's, you know, kind of full of himself, but he's also a badass too. On top of that, you find out. So it's at least a variation on that trope, I guess, is something you can give the show credit for. But I think this first episode is a perfectly adequate, you know, introduction to this series. It's you know, pretty formulaic. You can see where it's going fairly quickly, and it goes there and nowhere else. But you know, it's a well produced show. It does some, you know, has some solid voice acting, some solid sound effects, and of course, Mr. Goldsmith.
Yeah, after this, I said to myself, if I were a listener at the time with not a lot of entertainment options, I would have probably tuned into this show when convenient.
Sure. I would have followed it too.
Yeah.
And even when Goldsmith leaves, his theme keeps getting adapted in the scores, which is kind of the iconic solo trumpet sound you associate with many later famous Goldsmith scores. Interestingly, in this first episode, of course, this was live radio and he was conducting it. So it's kind of funny that at the very beginning, there's this major brass flub as they're introducing this series. And it just makes you realize, you know, they couldn't go back and redo that or you know, record it in advance or something. Because, I mean, did that stand out to you guys that there was such
there was performance flubs all over these scores.
I know. If anything, it seemed, well, we'll talk about the second score next, but it seemed like that one, which was conducted by Wilbur Hatch instead, it seemed like there were less mistakes in it. So I wonder if this was Jerry Goldsmith kind of learning to conduct, really. Although this was done after his first feature film score, Black Patch, which we'll be discussing in our episode one. That, of course, was not done live. So if there was a mistake, he could go back and correct it.
It's a solid theme, though, you know, when it's performed correctly. And, you know, one of the things I like about it, and I'm not a musically inclined person, if people haven't already figured out that obvious fact, but I like the little kind of unexpected note in the theme when it goes da 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 and has that jazzy almost sort of element in that one little bit.
It adds a melancholy feel to it.
Yeah, and I thought of that as maybe that's his way of sort of musically indicating that there's something just a little bit different about this series with the sort of outsider in the West than your average Western show. Maybe that's me reading too much into it, but it's a good theme, and that little element of it kind of helps it stand out for me.
I really like the version in the outro as well, because it's the one time in this first episode that he really gets to write something more long form.
I thought also there's a decent, the second cue after the main theme, when we sort of get the scene set and the narrator speaking about him traveling and then arriving in this new town.
The journey had taken 98 days from St. Louis. I had come by riverboat up the Missouri, the little stern wheeler climbing, churning, scuttling over 2,000 miles of sandbar and rapid. Then into the lonely wastes of another, swifter stream, the Yellowstone, until we finally docked at South Sunday in Montana Territory. My ticket had cost $300, which left me about 50 in my pocket, and the slim hope that there would be a letter at the express office with my remittance.
But overall, many of the cues in this first episode are really there to convey scene and location changes.
Which was common on a lot of radio shows of the era, as we mentioned earlier in the program. A lot of composers were tasked with essentially handling these transitions and not really interfering with the drama for the most part.
Yeah, actually in this first score, aside from that opening establishing cue, which is 45 seconds long, and there's not a single one that's longer than 18 until we get to the very end and it kind of plays out into the main theme again. But I will say, for all these little transitional cues that are, you know, around 15 seconds, it does stand out, like, and it does feel very Goldsmith, like a simple flash of melody makes an impression, or a roll of the timpani. He does make his voice heard, even with a short amount of time.
Absolutely.
So let's move on to episode 2, A Meeting with Sitting Bull.
A.K.A. Charlie Meeker.
Yes, I got a little confused by that originally.
There are alternate episode titles for these, apparently.
In this episode, J.B. Kendall meets another newspaper man, this one for the Montana Telegraph, who goes by the name of Charlie Meeker. Charlie believes that there's going to be a war with the Sioux, but Kendall is mostly concerned with Charlie setting him up to meet Sitting Bull for an interview. And Charlie is all classic old-timey reporter about this, you know, what a story! But then immediately seems to change his mind when it occurs to him that it's dangerous. But Kendall still goes, finds himself an Indian guide to take him to Sitting Bull anyway. Then we're on the journey, and Kendall is riding with Charlie all of a sudden. Even I didn't think that Charlie was going to come with, from how he reacted before, but they're traveling together. They meet their Indian guide, who takes them through the treacherous Sioux territory. But of course, this is where everything has gone far too smoothly so far for there not to be a surprise attack that complicates the journey.
So what I like about this episode is that there's a little more character development in it. I mean, as much as you would expect for a show of this type, but it feels a little more developed than the first one. And there's conversations that are sustained.
It's a little bit more interesting than the first episode in that it's as you say, it has better character development and it has a slightly less conventional story, I suppose. I will say one thing I wasn't crazy about in this episode is that the actor who plays their Native American guide sounds like some CBS bit player who's just doing the least convincing Native American accent in the world. And it really sort of, you know, radio being something you're drawn into on a audio level, it really kind of kills the spell for me of this episode a little bit. Just how bad that accent sounds.
You got $50, Silver? Kind of high, isn't it?
Sitting Bull won, big chief. You want me to take you to Red Cloud, Crazy Horse? Maybe cost less.
It's one step up from the Indians in the Disney Peter Pan.
Right. It's pretty bad. But yeah, it's all right. Certainly shows that the series isn't going to be doing the same thing every single week.
It's nice that it's not stuck in town also.
Yeah, I was really afraid in the first episode that we were just going to be in that small town forever, because they spent quite a bit of time establishing the sheriff and various townspeople, mm-hmm. that I felt those were going to be recurring characters, but they have not recurred yet in these first three.
I was really surprised at the end of the first episode that the Lila just leaves. She disappears. In any case, there seems to be a pattern of we're not going to have other characters continually developed besides the main one, perhaps.
Yeah,
is that,
I don't know.
Is that safe
I feel
to
like
say?
Yes.
For these first three, for sure, I'm sure those people are going to come back, right? Else, why would we establish them?
Mm-hmm. It seems a waste to establish a character and then discard them one way or another. And it's not as if the show doesn't have a larger story arc in mind. Apparently it does. But it doesn't seem to take that, you know, planning ahead in terms of the story to heart when it comes to the characters that are introduced.
But musically, we can say this episode is a good deal more interesting than the first one, and the music gets to do more this time around.
There's more opportunity here for riffs that can repeat and intensify over time, especially in the traveling music, which is at first bold and colorful, but then turns dark and apprehensive when we get to Sioux territory.
Morning was gray, a bit windy. We left Rosebud at 6 o'clock and rode steadily toward the southeast. I could see no sign of a gun on our guide, Johnny Duchelle, but his bulky jacket could have hidden an arsenal. For perhaps over an hour, we didn't speak. Charlie, red-eyed from want of sleep and too much whiskey, nodded in his saddle.
Yeah, the second half of this episode in particular is very heavily scored. I would say there's maybe a cue every minute in the second half of some kind, and most of them are at least 20 seconds long, sometimes as long as 40 seconds, and finally at the end, one that's almost a minute and a half long even before the ending music. So there's much more sustained musical engagement when compared with the prior one. The shortest piece of music in this is as long as the longest piece of music in the previous one, it felt like. In terms of music that stands out, Jens, there was one that you particularly liked.
So Kendall reflects on his time back in India and he talks about how his traveling companion is beheaded. There we get a trilly and frantic diversion into horror writing.
And I had that odd sensation of having lived this moment before. It had been in Peshawar, in northern India. I remembered a good friend who had walked away from me in the night. The next morning, his head was thrown through the barracks window.
Shall we move to the third and more disappointing episode score for me?
In the Honky Tonkers, J.B. Kendall goes to a honky tonk. Immediately gets himself into a bar fight, then runs into a drunk fellow named Wild Bill Bascom. And, like in the pilot, Kendall gets on his bad side right away by talking to his gal. Which, if this show has taught me anything, it's never ever talk to a lady in the Wild West. Because the moment that you do, you've got a brawl or a gunfight on your hands.
But if you're J.B. Kendall, you'll be perfectly all right and show everyone how much better you are. It may even give you opportunity to discover a new profession you're an expert at.
True. So yeah, there's an altercation. Bill ends up shot. And then Kendall has to operate.
Almost nothing happens except a lot of saloon source music gets played while people talk, and then he does medical stuff.
Yeah, like the only vaguely interesting thing in this episode is that, you know, he has, I wouldn't call it a crisis of conscience or anything, but he has just a flicker of guilt about his role in how this man wound up, and I wish the episode had maybe explored that a little bit more, that, you know, maybe J.B. Kendall shouldn't J.B. Kendall so much, but that
maybe should be a little more concerned.
Right, but that element of self-doubt is a new shade, even if it's, you know, kind of
fleeting.
Yeah, brief, but interesting anyway, unlike the rest of the episode.
Honestly, I started mentally checking out pretty early on. And
yeah,
really had to push myself to finish this one.
Well, I think part of that is the lack of Jerry Goldsmith music for so long. You know, with the saloon source music taking over for most of the episode, aside from that establishing cue of Honky Tonk early on, which also has a brief bit of Native American kind of styled music that recalls the previous episode. There's no music until halfway through that you'd consider scoring. And even then, the most sustained cues in this episode are 40 seconds long or less. So that it just really doesn't have the development of the previous one, which was kind of disappointing to me. I thought we were turning the bend and Jerry Goldsmith was pushing the boundaries of the medium and was going to be, you know, writing more. But if anything, this one was more disappointing to me than the first episode for most of it.
This one's really more of on a technical level, more of a showcase for the sound effects and sound design team. There's a lot going on in the background mm-hmm. of this episode. It's very busy, you know, with all the honky-tonk noise and everything taking place.
Atmosphere.
Back there. Yeah, yeah, but it's just not got a whole lot going on musically.
One cue that might be worth playing is at about the 20-minute mark near the end where... J.B. Kendall is sort of, to me, creepily admiring this woman who he describes as not exactly pretty, but he says she has a quality of loveliness. And it's only 35 seconds long, but it is some pretty music.
We bound up the wound, made him as comfortable as we could. He'd lost a great deal of blood and was terribly weak. There was nothing to do now but wait. The two girls stayed in a room with me, and there was something very different about them. Both were far from being beautiful, but there was a softness, a quality of loveliness which made their garish costumes seem completely out of place.
Okay, so we have a few spoiler things that we want to talk about. So if you care about being surprised by the three Frontier Gentlemen episodes... please pause here and listen to them before this part. You can get them and 1,489 words on archive.org, by the way.
Or YouTube for Frontier Gentlemen.
And I know each and every one of you are rushing out to begin that Frontier Gentlemen marathon right now.
It's only 42 episodes long.
We'll continue with spoilers after the beam.
So, the first episode of Frontier Gentlemen had the most satisfying ending of the three. Kendall tricks the Sheldon brothers into a standoff where he has the upper hand and he disarms them, and he's extremely smug about it, right? It's exactly what, presumably, you want from the show, a pompous Englishman besting American hicks.
And he does it
right.
with style.
But he loses the girl. I thought there was maybe some potential for romance, and, you know, he just puts her on her train and she leaves.
That relationship would have some complications further down the line.
Complications which we are now spared.
Right.
Yeah, it was a little too neat of a bow for my taste. I would have been more interested in something more open-ended, but, you know, that's probably my modern sensibilities.
Yeah, I mean, it's the ending you expect. For a pilot episode, I think it's fine. You know, it gets the job done.
So the second episode, though... which sets up the premise of being about Kendall meeting Sitting Bull. It just turns out to be about an Indian ambush.
Well, I think they're leading the audience on. They make you think you're going to get Sitting Bull, but they're going to save that for a future episode. It's unexpected filler.
I absolutely blame Kendall for getting Charlie killed at the end of this thing. Charlie told him from the beginning that this was basically suicide, and yet they went on the expedition.
So this is him being a little too overconfident or cocky or something.
But you're right, this whole thing was really done at Kendall's insistence because he wants to score this big story with Sitting Bull. And obviously we never
He's
get
a British
to that
menace.
You mentioned the alternate titles. I think they may have renamed it Charlie Meeker at some point just because they knew people would be disappointed if they'd never actually get to Sitting Bull. I'm like, no, Charlie's the star here.
Gotta name this episode in his honor. at the very least, we got a really touching piece of music out of it.
It's when he's taking Charlie's body back. That's the most sustained scoring in this entire series, I think, that Goldsmith does. It's almost a minute and a half, and it's really beautiful.
I took Charlie back to Rosebud, to Dolly's place. She had me put the little man on the parlor couch. Then she knelt by his side, took his hand in hers.
Charlie, boy, it's Dolly. This was my place, huh, mister? Like the one I never had. My good, bad boy. Dolly misses you, Charlie boy. Wake up, son.
Most of Rosebud attended the funeral of Charles Meeker. I sent the story to his own newspaper, as well as to the London Times. And for Charlie, I decided to stay on in Rosebud to have another shot at a meeting with Sitting Bull.
And with the third episode, there isn't much more to talk about. Kendall successfully operates. Everyone is cool with what happened.
Well, I was going to say the spoiler is the guy surprisingly lives. Like, it seemed like he's going to die. And then at the end, in narration, we hear, oh, he actually lived.
The main thing I was wondering about was whether or not that saloon owner was able to get the stain out of his rug from where the guy got shot, because he was so concerned about it. And the episode makes a big deal about how it cost him $300 and, you know, take the body off that rug, go put him on the table in the back. I don't know if he ever got it cleaned, but I hope so.
Yeah, if you'd think at that point the rug was already ruined.
Right, you would think so, but he
just use it to transport the body.
Or maybe he was going to, like, cut a piece off of it and, you know, try and use the rest of it.
This fulfills only the barest requirements of being a story.
Yeah. All right, well, it was sort of a disappointing ending to Goldsmith's involvement in the series, but as he would often do later in television, he just kind of scores the pilot and maybe a few episodes after that to set the tone of the show, and other composers who we don't remember as much today take over from there and, you know, shepherd it on to the end. But he was leaving this to go on to something bigger and better, which was the film world.
Well, I hope folks have enjoyed this journey through Mr. Goldsmith's early years of his career, and I hope they'll tune in to the next episode where we begin our proper Goldsmith odyssey with an exploration of the film Black Patch.
What? It is Dr. Jekyll. I don't understand.
Beast and the monster. The angel. It was an unholy thing he did. Separating them?
True. True. But only the good remains.